Carl Stewart is an investment advisor representative of Carl Stewart Investment Advisor Incorporated. Call or text Carl now at 512-836-0590. Now, here's Carl.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. Now into our 30th year here together, Money Talk is a broadcast about the world of financial and investment planning, where you always determine our agenda by calling or texting 512-836-0590. You may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com or go there and download previous broadcasts. Also, you can go to the free app SoundCloud and download those broadcasts as well. And this Thursday after the news at 6 p.m., we will rebroadcast today's show. It's a great idea to call or text at the beginning of the hour. I take today's calls first, and then today's texts, and then any previous texts that I haven't had a chance to fully answer. I do not have any of those, so we have lots of time here together this afternoon. I do actually have some bloviation material. That ought to frighten you. So give me a call or send me a text at 512-836-0590. Once a month, I get a series of charts and graphs from BlackRock, which is the largest asset manager in the world with over $10 trillion of assets. And they put out a lot of historical data that I find very interesting. And I've got several of those that I will share with you. I think particularly this first one, because we've had a rough week in the U.S. stock market. It's easy to think in very short term. But we had a great first quarter, first calendar quarter. In fact, the first quarter in this, they use the S&P 500. The first quarter was a 10.6% return. And they go to show the average quarterly return for given calendar years from all the way back in 1926. The average first quarter return for all years was 2.4%. And in election years, it was 1.3%. And yet here we were, up over 10%. So they went back and looked from 1926 for periods of 10% or more return for stocks in the first calendar quarter. And what was the performance over the 9 months of the calendar year since then? And it turns out that there were 15 of those occurrences, and only two out of those 15, that would be 13%, those following 9 months were negative, following 3 months starts to the year that were 10% or greater, which is, you know, pretty unusual. In fact, the average that was above 10% in the first quarter was 14.4%, and the next 9 months average was 8.5%. I think all of us as investors, if we could make 10% in the first quarter and the next 9 months, 8.5%, I think we'd probably be pretty happy with that. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Okay, here's another one. When stocks are positive and bonds were negative in the first quarter, it's only the 11th time since 1926 that the first 3 months of the calendar year saw stocks as positive returns and bonds as negative returns. 11 out of 99 years. And what happened was this, when stocks start positive and bonds negative, what happened? It was 10.6%, as I said, in this year, and bonds down 0.8. The average return for the rest of the year when stocks are positive is 10.7 when bonds are negative, and bonds come back and have a positive return to 3.2%. So performance for years in which stocks started positive and negative, the average stocks for the year were then 10.7 and bonds 3.2. I'm going to keep going. If you don't call or text, 512-836-0590. Now, there's a lot of talk in the financial markets, if you have nothing better to do than to pay attention to that, about what the Federal Reserve is going to do as it regards interest rates. At the beginning of this year, the futures market was suggesting that people were betting there might be six or as many as seven interest rate cuts in 2024. That's down now to about two, and there are some economists who are suggesting that there may not be any cuts in interest rates. And if you have a Fed rate cut and it doesn't result in a recession, that's been good for stocks historically. That's the so-called soft landing, where that they begin to cut rates. Let's just suppose that there are two rate cuts remaining this year and that we don't go into a recession this year or next year. Then what happens? Stocks have benefited when rate cuts don't coincide with a recession in the following 12 months. And this is now from the first of 1984 to through March of this year. And when the Fed rate cuts and there's a recession, here's what happens. Tech stocks drop 6%. But if there's no recession, tech stocks as a group return 38%. So-called quality stocks drop 4%. U.S. stocks drop 5.6%. And value stocks drop 11%. So there is a lot of focus on not only on what the Fed's going to do, but frankly, whether or not we're going to have a recession. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Let's see if this is, there's a text here. I'm looking, it came in at 304, so I don't think, no, that's exactly, it's not us. 512-836-0590. Now, here's somewhat interesting kind of tidbit, and it regards the stock sectors that do the best depending on who's been president. But even that, it looks to me like I end up having a text, thank goodness. If you look at the average annual return for the length of the presidency, and we're going back and looking at Presidents Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden, it turns out that both Biden's and Bush's top performing sector in the stock market, you wouldn't believe this, was energy. Technology remained in the top two sectors for four of the five presidents. And remember, these presidencies can be 8 years. The top three performing sectors were the same under Obama and Trump, as well as the worst, which was energy. And we've talked a lot on Money Talk about how you can't possibly know which sector is going to be a leader from year to year. I was just looking here. During the Obama years, energy was the worst, and during the Biden years, energy has been the best. I think that's a pretty good lesson right there. 512-836-0590. Okay. So I've got another text coming in. All right. Looks to me like, you know what, I'm having a little problem here with our software. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue to talk. 512-836-0590. I'll be back.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. I've got my software fixed here. It's a great time to call or text 512-836-0590. Anita, you're on the air. How may I help?
Hi, Carl.
Hi.
I'm calling to follow up on a question I had asked a little while back, and one of your listeners had some information for me.
Yeah.
So this was not taking out the RMD for a inherited IRA.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the instructions for that form.
Mm-hmm.
That's form 5329, and
mm-hmm.
indeed, the person who answered was a 10% penalty
mm-hmm.
is what is, it could be 25, but if you read through all of the instructions,
mm-hmm.
you can literally ask for a waiver of tax for reasonable cause.
Oh, terrific. Yeah,
that was, I think, what the person
yes.
in the retirement section of the brokerage firm
yes.
had said.
Yes.
And so I actually found, you know, where you're supposed to do this or explains
Great.
It.
Great.
And then the IRS will review the info you provide and decide whether to grant your request for a waiver. And then there's a little bit more, you know, on
yeah.
that, which people would want to read. But you can also send this in separately from your return, you know, the
mm-hmm.
the tax, and you
sure.
have to pay it. You can't just say, I want you to,
right.
you know, you have to pay it, and then they'll decide, you
yes.
know. Okay, so my question would be this. If any of your listeners have had any, you know, experience with
mm-hmm.
doing this,
mm-hmm.
and if maybe there's some other information I hadn't
sure.
thought about,
sure. Good.
Whether or not it's a reasonable thing to do, if
yes.
They've had success, mm-hmm. especially sending it in separately, because mm-hmm. you can't send the letter if you are electronically filing. You have to do it separate, which you can.
Right.
So
yeah, good. Well, that's terrific. Well, that's very good information, and I know you're a regular listener, and let's hope between now and 5 o'clock somebody who's had that experience can visit with
yeah.
us. Thanks for calling,
Thank
Anita.
Thank you, Carl. Bye.
You're welcome. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here's a text. Carl, I'm seeking to start an investment account. I believe you suggested investment programs for starters. Can you repeat suggestions? Well, I think when we talk about an investment account, and here's I think the rules of the road, and frankly my assumptions with the word investment account, and that is that I am going to, whatever this investment is, it's my intention, barring unforeseen circumstances, to have a minimum of a 3 to 5 year horizon. And the reason for that is you can look at the 3 years preceding this year. 2021 was an excellent year for the stock market. 2022 was a terrible year for the stock market. 2023 was a great year for the stock market. That's not terribly unusual. So time is your best friend when you're making investments, whether that's in real estate or stocks or bonds or whatever. So if I were starting and I had at least a 3 to 5 year horizon and I didn't have anything else in investments, I would start by investing in an index fund that covered the most number of stocks. And there are plenty of firms that offer index funds. The well-known ones like Fidelity and Vanguard, certainly also Schwab. You can go online to the various websites of these companies and look and learn from that. I think you'd start with a domestic stock index. The most popular one, in my experience, is a Standard & Poor 500. That's just fine. I like something called the total stock market because you do get a broader, you get more stocks. Now, there's not going to have exactly the same performance. For example, through yesterday, the Vanguard total stock market's up 7.03 using their ETF, and the Spider S&P 500's up 9.6. So you're going to get some dispersion in returns, but you get a broader diversification. So I would start with that. And I think you would want to look at the custodian and see if they have a minimum. But I think that's how I would get started. And finally, I would say, and the regular listeners I know this, that if you can go into a regular program, have it set up, what they call ACH, have it set up to where on a monthly basis or whatever's comfortable for you with your budget, to have money taken out of your checking or savings account and invested directly in this account, that would be a terrific thing to do, because in that example of 2021, 22, and 23, if you had been putting money in every month, today you'd have a lower average cost because of the bad year of 2022. And when people were concerned about the outlook for rising interest rates, you were buying more of the stock fund. And that turns out to be a very good idea. So thanks for the text. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here's the text. What is the easiest way for me to start a Roth? Do I have to have a starting amount, or can I open with 50? I think it depends on the custodian. If you're going to do this yourself and you're starting out and you have modest amount of money, again, that's somewhat of the same answer I just gave to the other text, and that is I would go, because these big mutual fund companies like Fidelity and like Vanguard and these big custody firms like Schwab have, you can open accounts directly with them. And so you would go and look at their websites and see if they have a minimum. I frankly suspect they would, just because opening an account and leaving it fallow and having zero in, it's going to cost them money. And so I think it probably does, but that's how I would start. I suspect the starting amount is quite modest. And if you're going to start a Roth, of course, you have to have what we call earned income, which means it's not income from interest or dividends or Social Security or pension, but it's income from work, whether that's W-2 income or if you're an independent contractor, 1099 income. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here's the text. Carl, if you have a brokerage account like Vanguard, and you have a transfer on death, does the heir get a stepped up in basis upon your death? The answer is yes. I'm assuming transfer on death, that means it's not a retirement or some kind of tax deferred account. That's my understanding, that when you pass away with capital assets, real estate, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, that your heir gets a step up in basis. If you have a joint account and you predecease your spouse, he or she gets a step up in basis. If it's a non-spouse and it passes per your desires in your will, you get a step up in basis. And for everybody else, that's kind of a technical term. What am I talking about? Because I think this is probably the single best thing at tax law that I'm aware of. So step up in basis means this. Let's suppose that I have a brokerage account, as you call it, a taxable investment account at Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab or Merrill Lynch or UBS or wherever. And let's suppose that years and years ago I invested $200,000 and now it's worth $400,000 and I pass away. My heir, or if I'm married and it's and my spouse, but regardless of whom that human being is, their cost basis now becomes $400,000. We call it a step up in basis, but the truth of the matter is it could be a step down. I could have bought securities that declined in value, and my heir's cost basis will be the value at the time of my demise. If it's real estate, that is a little trickier because you don't see quotes for that online. Of course, if it's a residential, you own the residential real estate, you have a $250,000 of gain before you pay taxes, or married $500,000. But if you pass away and as a single person and you have a home and it's appreciated and your kids get the home, they have a step up in basis. So that means that those assets can either be held and now have a higher cost basis and sold later, and there'd be less in the way of capital gains tax, or if they sell it, there would be very little. Presumably the marketplace for your home or your portfolio hasn't dramatically changed, then you're going to find that you have very little in the way of taxes. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Again, going back to some of these bloviation pieces that I got this week, there's a lot of conversation about how much money is in money market funds. And that's not surprising, $6.1 trillion. We've lived through many, many years of very low interest rates. And now many money market funds will yield 5% or more. Not money market accounts, but money market funds, which are mutual funds designed to stay at $1 per share in net asset value. And they buy high quality securities and then pass through the interest to you. And you do have daily liquidity. So there's been a big increase in the use of those for obvious reasons. And at the same time, there's been a decline in the amount of money in bond funds. And we'll get into that probably in the second half. And as a result of that, they're both sitting at that $6.1 trillion of the total percentage of the total industry assets of $33.8 trillion, 6.1 each. In money market mutual funds and in bond funds. And here's the interesting piece. Their performance following periods when money market or bond assets or bond fund assets are greater, the following 12-month performance in each scenario, and this goes back to January 1st of 1993, when money market assets are larger than bond assets, okay, what happens in the next 12 months? Bonds deliver 6.9%, money market funds 3%. When bond assets are larger than money market assets, not much happens. In the next 9 months, money market funds deliver 1.1%, bonds 1.5%. And the implications of that are pretty darn significant. We may get into that in the second half of Money Talk. It's a great time to call or text before I take a break at 512-836-0590. I'll be back.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. When you have a question, call or text 512-836-0590. And you can listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com or go there at your convenience, download podcasts of previous shows. You can do the same thing at the app SoundCloud. And this Thursday after the news at 6 p.m., we will rebroadcast today's show, 512-836-0590. I was talking about in the past when money market fund assets have equaled bond fund assets, that's turned out probably to be an interesting time to consider. If you're an investor, I'm not trying to suggest that if you're a saver, that's someone who has a shorter term time horizon. But if you're an investor, that becomes an interesting time based on history to consider moving some of that money market fund assets into bonds. Here's another piece I think that is we've living through this, and it's kind of hard to actually realize this. The title of the piece is Longest Bond Bear Market in History. Let me just show you the largest drawdowns for core bond index from January 1st of 1926 through the end of March this year. The maximum number of months. So these are the four longest bond bear markets. In 1954 to 56, bonds went down in price for 16 months. From June of 1980 to November of 1981, another decline for 16 months. And from May of 1958 until March of 1960, 21 months. The peak was in July of 2020, and the end of this bear market has yet arrived, and that's 44 months. Also, they also had the largest drawdown, meaning loss. In those other ones, the losses ranged for bond funds or bonds from 2 to 9%. Currently, it's down about 10.5%, from the peak to the bottom was 17.2% now. That's pretty remarkable. So if it makes sense to you to buy things of quality when they're out of favor, then you would have to look and say, certainly this bond bear market, you have to say quality bonds, investment grade bonds, tax exempt municipal bonds are out of favor. So far this year, the Bloomberg Ag, it used to be called the Barclay, has a return. And again, I'm using the ETF because you can't buy an index. The AGG is down 2.45% this year. And the largest bond fund, the Vanguard Total Bond Market, is down 2.35%. So if you are a contrarian or you like to buy things when they're out of favor and you have money in a money market fund, I think you'd have to look at history and suggest that maybe this is a time to make a bit of a shift in your asset allocation. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. I've got a couple of pieces that are frankly more arcane, and we have one of the things I really enjoy about Money Talk is that we have this huge, we have this huge spread of people who are savers and investors, people who are just getting started, who want to understand what CDs and bonds and stocks and mutual funds are, and then we have people who have listened for years who are really sophisticated investors and either manage their own portfolios or have an advisor, but really understand the financial markets. And I'm going to talk to you about a couple of things. And if you are a beginning investor, then I think you may or may not find this interesting. But in no way am I recommending some of these unusual kinds of strategies. I'm just pointing out that in circumstances like we're in today, some other strategies have performed. So alternative asset classes, this says, do better historically when stock and bond correlations are higher. So what would be the ones when stock and bond correlations are greater? Then what happens is hedge funds do 12.4%, equity market neutral 8%, global macro 16.7%, and multi-strategy 8.4%. That's a lot of jargon. But there are mutual, you don't have to be a pension fund or a foundation to own these. For those of you who are interested in this, you can do your own homework or work with your advisor if you have one, because equity market neutral, there are several of those out there from large mutual fund providers. Strategies go from just plain equity market neutral to merger arbitrage. And when we have the current kind of situation, that becomes pretty attractive. Based on history, no predictions. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns, right? 512-836-0590. I'm just going to keep going here. Remember to call or text. I'm going to bloviate. So those of you, I know some of you have listened for a long time, and I know that you've heard me talk about trend following or managed futures, and it is an unusual strategy for most people. You don't find it, at least I don't see it, in the menu of 401k investment choices. But having said that, the strategy of being able to trade the four most liquid global markets of stocks, bonds, being interest rates, currencies, and commodities, this has been going on for I don't know, as long as there have been, has been agriculture, as long as there have been commodities, because there are people who, let's just say my grandfather was, a farmer in northeastern Missouri, and he was raising soybeans and corn. And even before he harvested it, if he chose, he could sell it at a given price. He could sell it. Who could he sell it to? I'm going to make this up. He could sell it to General Mills because they wanted the soybeans or they wanted the corn to make into their products. And so he knew what his price was in advance. Now, if the harvest was smaller that year and prices went up, he would not benefit because he'd already locked in the price. And if the harvest was great and the prices fell, he'd already had locked it in. That's a very straightforward way of thinking about this whole idea of futures. They can be used by end users. For example, if you follow this, I suspect you don't, there's a big, big price hike in cocoa because of the African area where that comes from. There's been a real weather problems, and as a result of that, harvests have been diminished. And so chocolate prices are going to go up. And so that used to be what we call fundamental analysis in using what are called futures, and the whole idea is called managed futures or trend following. But the big shift really came once computing power became possible, and today these people use massive amounts of quantitative analysis and algorithms. And the idea is that when something starts to fall, it will fall for some considerable time, and you can have a profitable position with that. I've got some additional detail on this, but I've got a call. Gary, you're on the air. How may I help?
Yes, thank you, Carl. I had to let the dog out during your thing on the house valuations.
Yes.
As far as taxes.
Yes, yeah.
My wife passed away shortly ago, but we bought our house for like $85,000.
Right.
And now it's worth, the latest valuation, say $485,000 just for the thing. Does that mean that the valuation of the house that I can use now is $485,000 versus $85,000?
Yes.
Because my wife passed?
Yes. So you both owned the home. I actually had this situation occur recently. Friends, husband and wife, a husband passed away. and the surviving spouse, in this case the wife, sold the house very shortly after his demise, within, I'm making this up, 60 days, let's just say, and her cost basis on that sale was the value at the time of his demise. Now, if the gain were $250,000 or less, based on my understanding of the statute, she wouldn't have any taxable gain. But if it were, to use your example, if the gain's $400,000, then theoretically you'd be subject to tax on the $150,000 over the $250,000. But because your spouse passed away and you owned it jointly, your cost basis is now $485,000. If you decide at some point in the future to sell your home, that's going to be the determination. And the odds are, I think we would both agree, because you've shared with me in your age, the odds that it's going to go from $485,000, you know, up another $250,000 in your lifetime is probably pretty limited. And so I think if you were to sell it during your lifetime, you'd likely have no tax liability because of the step up in basis. And as always, you and I are not CPAs and tax attorneys, but that's absolutely my understanding of how the tax law works, Gary.
Exactly. You've given me a great financial help, but I'm ignorant as a lawyer.
Yeah. That's pretty darn ignorant, I guess. All right.
Okay,
well,
thank you, Carl. That's a great help.
Yes.
The step up in basis.
Yeah.
I mean, that would really reduce the taxes.
Oh, my gosh. It's as I said at the beginning before you took the dog out, it's just about, I don't know of a better aspect of the tax code than the one you and I are talking about right now. It's a wonderful way to pass on assets either to your spouse or pass on assets to your heirs, kids or grandkids or whomever. They can then choose to sell or to hold because they will have really attractive tax consequences. Okay?
Correct. Thank you very much, Carl.
You bet. Have a good day. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. We're running out of time. Now's the time to call or text 512-836-0590. I shall return.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're here this afternoon for another 12 minutes. If you have a question, now's a great time to call or text 512-836-0590. Stan, you're on the air. How may I help?
Yeah, Carl.
Yes.
How about assets held in a revocable trust, like my home and my bank accounts or brokerage accounts?
Right. So the thing about trusts that everybody has to recognize is that the income tax rates are extremely high. You get to the 37% bracket with income coming out of the trust as little as around $15,000. It goes up a little bit. So if you had, you know, a sizable brokerage account, and it had dividends and interest from stocks and bonds and mutual funds, et cetera, you could end up with the trust tax could be quite high. So you really want to think about that. If your motivation is to avoid probate, then putting that in a living trust and you put all your assets in there, is my understanding. Then upon your death, because you don't own anything, all the assets are in the trust, those assets pass without probate. Now, according to the lawyers with whom I've visited, that's for the average citizen, avoiding probate in Texas may not be worth the price of the trust, because in Texas, we have something called independent administration. It's been explained to me, and the probate process is very straightforward and frankly pretty fast. Now, in other states, that's not always the case. I understand it's very complicated, for example, in Florida. So then the other reason to avoid is to avoid probate is that you've got a very large, you've got a multi-million dollar estate, and you don't want anybody to know about that. So, for example, let's assume that you're married and you're concerned that because the probate, what happens if probate's a matter open to the public, that your heirs or your surviving spouse or whoever are going to be the subject of scam artists because they recognize that, you know, these people are going to have $25 million or whatever, putting it in there to keep it secret, private, if you will. That's a reasonable thing to do. So you can put it in a trust. If it's a living trust, it has those characteristics. If it's not designed as a living trust and it's simply a revocable trust, you can put assets in there, and then you can identify who the beneficiaries are and who's the trustee. And there'd have to be some special reasons to do that because, as I said earlier, the income taxes can be quite onerous, and when trust income tax rates are much worse than individual rates. So that's kind of how I look about it, Stan.
Well, we have a revocable trust.
Yeah.
And it sound like I better get hold of a lawyer and a good tax account.
Yeah. Yeah, because I get the updated tax tables every year. And I can't do it by memory, but it's last year it was like anything over 14,000 and something was subject to that. And I'm going to see if I can get this quickly here. I don't want to take a lot of your time. It doesn't look like I've got this off the top of my head, but it gets fine. Yeah. Okay, well, good luck.
You bet. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Mary Ann, you're on the air. How may I help?
Hi, Carl.
Hi.
You know, I'm more of a stock person than a buying person, probably.
Yes.
And I'm just several family members and I were talking about taking income from bonds.
Yeah.
Could you go over that in a way that would make sense, particularly for today, if they were?
When you're thinking about taking income from bonds, first, you have to decide if you're going to own individual bonds or you're going to own bond funds. Now, the benefit of owning individual bonds is that it's the only investment asset that you know the future value and you know the future cash flow. You don't know that in real estate. You don't know that in stocks. You don't know that in CDs, money market funds, because when you reinvest, it'll be at a different rate. You buy a 10-year treasury. You know exactly what your yield and maturity is, and you know the date at which the money will turn into cash. Okay, now, having said that, what I like about bond funds is that you get to determine whether or not to take the income. When you own a bond or a series of bonds, they don't call you up and say, Marianne, is it okay if we keep your income and reinvest? That's not possible. That's what the academics call reinvestment risk. The beauty of bond funds is you can reinvest when they're bond funds, whether they're exchange-traded funds or open-end mutual funds, they're called dividends, but the tax consequences are the same, whether they're tax-exempt bond funds or they're taxable bond funds. And what I like about that is you can say, I want the income, fine, but your circumstances can change over time and you can reinvest. And because you have daily liquidity and the transaction costs to get in and out of a bond fund in today's world, if you're a do-it-yourself investor and you hold the assets at Schwab or someplace else, or if you're with an advisor and you have a no-transaction fee advisor who's working on an advisory fee basis rather than transaction basis, you can move that. You can change. You can manage your asset allocation. We have a bad year for bonds like 2022, and let's just pretend, not you personally, because you're right, you're a stock person, but if you have a 60-40 stock bond allocation. And your bonds drop to 35%, making your stock 65%. With basically the flip of a switch, metaphorically, you can end up rebalancing it. Very next to impossible to do that with individual bonds. And so you eliminate the reinvestment risk. It's a great way to manage a portfolio. And the other thing happens is, let's suppose that you need more than the current income. You own a bond fund. You can sell shares of the bond fund to increase. You don't just have to take the dividends. It's very hard. Let's say you own $50,000 of a bond. You want an extra $5,000. That's a little more technical, and your broker dealer's got to get a bid for that. But if you have $50,000 in ABC bond fund and you want $5,000, you just sell $5,000 value of the fund, and there you've got it. I prefer bond funds over individual bonds. And for people who are looking for income, I will tell you this. I'm doing a lot of studying on bonds because for the majority of my career, I've been a stock person as well. But there are times when bonds look more attractive than others. And I think we're in one of those times currently. And there's a lot of data that indicate the starting yield, when you buy bonds, the starting yield is likely the return you're going to get over time. And so I'm making this up, but I'm not far off. You buy an investment-grade corporate bond fund with a 5.5% or 6% yield, the odds are that's what's going to be your return over time. Well, that's pretty darn good when you consider that should outpace inflation, which is not always the case with bonds. And secondly, it gets darn close to the 8 or 9% that you can reasonably expect from stocks. So that's how I think about that, Marianne.
That's just great info. And it all makes sense. It certainly is. So currently, corporates, you can get them around the 5% or even a little more?
Yes, you can. You can. What you want to do, and I know you would do this, you can go look up, you can go to the various websites of the large producers of bonds. You can also go to, you don't even have to have a membership. You can go to Morningstar.com. And if you had this, and you can put in the symbol of the bond fund, or you can type in the name of the bond, it'll show you the symbol, and then you can do some homework with just numbers. You won't get any information about how the bond fund's managed or whatever. You need a membership for that, but you can go and start doing your homework there and seeing what the yields are. Yes.
Thank you, Carl.
Okay, you bet. You bet. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Here is an important text. Carl, trusts get a deduction for income distributed to beneficiaries who then pay the taxes at their own rates. That is usually much more efficient than paying trust tax rates. That's exactly right. Thank you so much. So I hope you're still listening, Stan. If the trust distributes the income to you as a beneficiary or to someone else, then they can pay taxes at their rate rather than keeping the money in the trust and being subject to very high trust rates. That's a great idea. Let me see here. I think I had another text coming in. Let's just look. Okay. Love the show. Thanks. Easiest explanation for my 30-ish daughter and son-in-law to fully fund a Roth before other retirement accounts. Well, I've got about a minute, so I'd like to talk about this in greater detail. When you're in your 30s and you have access to health care and you have good habits, you're not a smoker, you're not obese, you need to plan on living into your 90s. And the nice thing about Roth IRAs is they don't have a required minimum distribution. If you do a good job of saving and investing, and you're in a 401k or other tax-deferred investments, it's going to be real nice to have a pool of capital when you're 60, 70, and 80 that you know you can go get tax-free when you want, but you don't have to have it taken out. And upon your demise, your spouse can have it. And upon his or her demise, the heirs can get it and have up to 10 years to take the money out, fully income tax-free. Now, the other thing is they're in their 30s. Get started with a Roth, because if their income moves up over time, they'll be subject to an income test. It'll be more difficult, not impossible, but more difficult to do a Roth. Well, that's the end of the broadcast today. I want to thank Kyle for doing his usual terrific job. I want to thank you for listening, and I invite you to join me next Saturday for Money Talk.
Carl Stewart is an investment advisor representative of Carl Stewart Investment Advisor Incorporated.